to the second case this morning, DH2 versus the Securities Exchange Commission. Bergen.
Good morning. My name is Charles Bergen, and I'm here representing the petitioner, DH2 Inc. DH2 is a Northbrook, Illinois-based investor in mutual funds and similar products such as variable annuities containing separate sub-accounts, which effectively trade as mutual funds. In this petition, DH2 seeks review of the SEC's fair value rule, by which the SEC, for the first time, requires mutual funds and variable annuities to stop using readily available same-day market prices for securities in their funds, and instead to substitute what it calls fair value pricing, pricing that is subjective, non-market management estimates, when the fund management considers the same-day market prices to somehow be unreliable. DH2 challenges this rule for three reasons. First,
counsel, I don't want to you handle your argument however you want to. You're going to address the standing and other issues relating to our jurisdiction.
I would be happy to address those if the court has concerns. And with regard to standing, if that is an issue, the first thing I would point out is that DH2 is an owner of these funds. The claim the SEC makes is that somehow the owners, the people who own the property, the people for whom the fund managers work, our agents, our fiduciaries, that we're excluded from this process. And I think that's just wrong. I think it's a misreading of the cases. Constitutional standing, we have money at stake. It's our legally protected interest that we're fighting for. The harm being done by a mechanism that's been imposed for non-market pricing creates a concrete and real injury to us. And it's traceable to the challenged conduct of the SEC, and that the SEC is now requiring the use of non-market prices rather than simply permitting it. It's also the case, as is shown in the supplemental appendix filed by the SEC, that by passing this rule, the SEC attempts to alter rights among private parties as well. By changing the rule, by changing the law, this would affect our contractual rights vis-a-vis the fund managers who we've employed to handle our money in these funds. So that was my concern on standing. If there are other issues on rightness, I'd be happy to address those too.
What is the injury, counsel, that you're claiming?
The injury that we're claiming is harm in at least three ways. First, every day we have millions of dollars at risk in the market. We are unable, under this new rule, to count on having objective, verifiable pricing. The pricing has now been turned over to fund managers in contravention of the original intent of the 1940 Act. The 1940 Act, as you saw in our briefs, was a reaction to fund managers who did not price fairly. And as a result, the ICA required objective, verifiable market prices whenever they were readily available. This rule turns that on its head. The SEC takes its delegated authority from Congress. In turn, delegates it to fund management and says, you guys figure out when these prices will be required, how you should determine them, and when you should determine them, taking away our protection under the Investment Company Act to have objective, verifiable prices.
What is the injury that you are suffering?
The injury we are suffering is on days that we are buying at prices that are not market prices. On days that we sell at prices that are not market prices. Second, we face injury in that this, as a rule, would interfere with our private contractual rights with the funds themselves. And as an interpretation, as a permissive standard, we felt that the funds could be held accountable. As a mandatory rule, and there's no question that this is mandatory under the language that they use in the releases, we are injured vis-a-vis our rights to have those funds priced at accurate prices.
Okay. Have the funds challenged the SEC rule?
The funds have not challenged the rule. The funds, interestingly, had a voice in this rule through the ICI. And one of the reasons we object to the notice and comment procedure being avoided was that the ICI, an industry fund group, had an ongoing discussion with the SEC that's not disclosed until the rule came out. My client sent in FOIA requests, and this is part of our petition. This is in our complaint. Over a dozen saying, what information do you have on fair value pricing, on market timing, on short-term trading? And we're told the SEC doesn't understand those terms. We began sending those requests in December of 2001. The response is still not complete. So the ICI's voice has been heard, but the voice of investors has not been heard. The voice of the other government agencies has not been heard. And we included, for example, the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve, which raised real questions about fair value pricing and how it should be implemented. None of those voices have been heard. So have we been injured by the rule? We have. We have millions of dollars in the market every day at prices that we no longer can verify, the prices that are set subjectively and in a manner that Congress didn't intend. Congress intended prices to be objective and verifiable, and that's why they said whenever market prices are readily available, they must be used. This rule changes that. In the releases, it's clear that this is not just an interpretation. This is not something where the SEC is saying, this doesn't matter, it's not binding. If you look at the compliance rule release, and we have some of this in the brief, I'll just hit the highlights. They state, quote, in 1984, we stated that in these circumstances, a fund must, to the best of its ability, determine the fair value of the securities as of the time. You look at the 1984 release they refer to, it's a proposing release, never is adopted, and it's a staff position, not a commission position, and never had the force of law. They go on to say, fund directors who countenance such practices fail to comply with their statutory valuation obligations. Accordingly, Rule 38A1, the new compliance rule, requires funds to adopt policies and procedures that require the fund to monitor for circumstances that may necessitate the use of fair value. The best example I can give you was in the supplemental material that we submitted. For 44 years, there was never an enforcement proceeding against a fund that traded in marketable securities, not thinly traded things, not the mortgage cases or the loan cases that you see in Eaton Vance case or you see in the those cases. But what you see is, for the first time in October of this year, someone, the SEC going after people for failure to comply with this fair value rule. It is mandatory, it is new, and it departs from what Congress intended. The SEC goes on and talks about, in the disclosure rule, the same thing. And again, it presumes that fair value pricing is required. At page 70405 of the Federal Register, as described above, fair valuation of a fund's portfolio securities, which is required under certain circumstances, can serve to foreclose arbitrage opportunities. So this is a rule. This affects our rights against companies, it affects our pricing, it affects the dollars in our pocket, and it affects our relationship in a very real way with our agents and fiduciaries without our voice ever being heard. That's why when there's rulemaking, you have to have notice and comment from all the affected parties. That's why the agency can't simply act either on its own or with advice from one constituency, here the Investment Company Institute, but has to take into account the views of all.
If they would have taken your views into account and still arrived at the same outcome, how would that affect you?
Obviously, if they went through a reasoned decision-making process, if they took into account not only our views, but the views of the Fed, the views of the other funds that have commented briefly, and the views of the other investors who've contacted us since filing this, my sense is that they would have a broader approach, that they would look at other mechanisms beyond giving this untrammeled discretion to fund managers, that they would come up with some sort of active procedure to provide guidance so that investors, and we're not just investors, so that owners knew how their agents were handling their money. And they didn't do that. Moreover, they would explain a rationale for what they're doing. They would have to say, look, here are the benefits we've considered. Here are the risks or the costs we've considered. And they didn't do that. They would say, look, there are alternatives. And we all know there's alternatives out there. The reports are full of them. You could change the cutoff time. Instead of giving the managers time to fiddle with the prices, you could say, if you're concerned about European funds being affected tomorrow by what happens in the USA today, close the time at which European funds transactions will be done when their markets close, not when New York's markets close. They have that power under 22C1. They could do a rulemaking that would talk about the number of round trips. They could do an investigation that might demonstrate whether their underlying premises are even correct.
Well, one of their underlying premises seems to me, and I don't pretend to be an expert on this stuff, but it seems that the SEC perceives a major problem in inaccurate pricing of these securities, and your ability now to go in during this short window when there is mispricing and buy, that your ability to do that is greatly diminished now under this rule. So was there abuse in the market that this rule is intended to correct?
Clearly this rule arose out of some serious abuse by fund managers and by a couple funds in the market. The Canary scandal, which broke in September of last year, of 2003, led to action by not only Attorney General Spitzer, but to calls for action by Chairman Donaldson of the SEC and giving instructions to the SEC staff to do something. What they didn't do was look to see what was involved with the Spitzer investigation. It's not the situation here. Spitzer involved late trading after the close, after the 4 o'clock close. That's just illegal. That's just not proper. And they went after that. It involved consideration that was given to model the funds. Instead of giving the funds portfolios every day or every quarter as required, certain people got non-public information about the composition of those portfolios that let them game the system. And then there was a concern about, quote, abusive market timing, which meant trying to buy when you thought the market was going a certain way.
Well, that's what you do.
Well, it's not what we do.
Isn't it?
The SEC says it's what we do. What we do is we are active traders. And, again, a record would help here so that they can see.
I thought you swoop in at a time when the price is not accurately reflected by and then you're in and out.
So with all respect, that's nowhere in this record, and it's not what my clients do. My clients do trade short term. They do benefit if the pricing.
What's the definition of short term?
I don't know. And what's the definition of market timing? The SEC hasn't told us that either. It's posited that there are classes of investors, that there are short-term market timers, there are long-term investors, and that short-termers are interested in buying low and selling high, and that the long-termers somehow need to be protected. There are people who are more active than others, and I would propose that it's a continuum. I can tell you right now my guys are in a trade they've been in for about 45 days. That's unusually long for them, but that happens. So when the SEC starts casting these aspersions and saying that we're exactly like what they're trying to shut down, there's no basis for that in this record. And if they knew how people traded, they might be able to distinguish between people who are active but not harming others and people who may be harming others. As it is now, they rely almost entirely on the study of one professor, Eric Zitzewitz, from Stanford. Zitzewitz comes up with a theory, says it's costing about 48 basis points for this market timing problem. And Zitzewitz doesn't disclose certain other things. One, other academic studies since him have said that he's off by a factor of 4, by a factor of 10, but by a significant margin. Two, Zitzewitz has an undisclosed conflict of interest. Zitzewitz works for Financial Times FT International, which sells a product designed to sell to companies to help them market time. That's something that if you had notice and comment rulemaking, other experts could come in. Other academic papers could be considered. Other people's voices would be heard, and someone would say, you know, this Professor Zitzewitz that you're relying on, he's Harold Hill. He's the music man. He's coming in telling you you've got trouble in River City, and he's got a solution that he's going to sell you to cure it. That was not disclosed. So there is a real harm from doing this behind closed doors, and that's what the APA is designed to prevent. I think if they did do a reasoned decision making, there might be some variant, there might be some change in terms of cutoff time, closing time. Traditionally, what they've done is in 64, they had backward pricing. In 68, they went to forward pricing. Maybe they go to further forward pricing or they change the cutoff times. That's what they've done under the rules before. But they've always acted on pricing matters through rulemaking and not through this vague interpretation.
Is this SEC interpretation or reinterpretation the subject of litigation anywhere else in the country?
I'm not aware of any direct litigation concerning it, no. I believe this is the only case. Again, we've had contacts from people, but in one way, no, I'm not aware of it.
So no funds. I asked you earlier if there are any funds that challenge this.
We've had funds that have communicated with us. We've had organizations of funds that have communicated with us, but no.
Communicated with you is one thing. No, there's no challenge by any of the funds.
Correct.
Now, other than making this harder for you to do business, what legal obligations are placed on you by the SEC rule?
The legal obligations, there are no direct legal obligations. We are not regulated by the SEC. The obligations are placed on the people who manage our money and who are our
fiduciaries. That goes right to standing, then, doesn't it? And
well,
Judge Sykes' questions about what...
I think the Investment Company Act directly addresses that when they say in Section 1B that the policy behind the ICA is plainly declared that the interests of investors who are adversely affected shall be addressed by the Investment Company Act, particularly when investors purchase, pay for, or sell securities issued by investment companies without adequate, accurate, and explicit information. Under those circumstances, the statute plainly gives us standing. None of the cases by the cited by the SEC contain a statutory mandate for protection that the ICA has there.
But as I understand it, counsel, you really don't have a legally protectable interest here that is being injured. Your future opportunities to make money in the way you make money are what's at stake, as far as I understand the case.
No, even if we were long-term investors, even if we were medium-term investors or some other label, and I want to point out none of those labels exist in the rules, we're hurt today because we're not sure that we're going to get a market price when we sell. Even if you took a long-term investor, someone who put their money in 5 years ago and today decides, my child is starting college, I'm pulling the money out. If there's some event in the marketplace that leads the fund managers to want to perk up their returns or to want to calm their volatility, that person, like us, and we have millions of dollars in the market today, is hurt because they don't know that they're getting the price.
What entitles you to a market price?
The Investment Companies Act. It states, it's pretty clear.
That's what's being interpreted here, though, right?
Well, but the interpretation, the statute says, with respect to securities for which market quotations are readily available, the market value of such securities shall govern, and then only with respect to others. And what they're saying is that readily available means unreliable. That's just not so. Readily available has been, for years, interpreted as meaning readily available. It's there. It's available. These are same-day prices. These are thickly traded markets. This is Frankfurt. This is London. This is Japan. And those, for years, have been readily available.
What the statute really entitles you to is a price that reflects net asset value, right? And then it further defines how net asset value is arrived at depending upon the circumstances and their substantial give.
Well.
And that's what you make money exploiting, as I understand.
I won't say that we don't benefit from it, but I wouldn't say that our strategy is to exploit that. No, that's not true. But what I will say is that people like Chairman Donaldson and people like Doug Scheit, who wrote the 2001 letter that's now being turned into law, have said things. Donaldson says there's a large difference between unavailable and non-reliable. Presumably, quotations are usually available, but perhaps unreliable. You're sort of using those terms interchangeably.
Let me ask you this. If we were to say that you had standing to make this challenge and that this interpretation by the SEC should have been promulgated pursuant to notice and comment rulemaking, and the SEC then promulgated the exact same interpretation pursuant to notice and comment rulemaking, you'd still be challenging it, wouldn't you?
I think it would eliminate two of the three legs of our challenge. We wouldn't argue that it violated the APA. We wouldn't argue that they hadn't engaged in reasonable decision-making, perhaps. But we would certainly still argue that it violated the plain language of the statute, depending on what they came up with after they heard all of the voices. Speaking of heard all the voices, I'm into my rebuttal time. Why don't I save a little bit?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Bergen. Ms. McCaffrey?
May it please the Court, Donna McCaffrey for the Respondent, Securities and Exchange Commission. This Court should dismiss DH2's petitions because DH2 lacks standing and its claims are not ripe. Additionally, DH2's claims are meritless. The challenge statements are an interpretation of the Investment Company Act, not a legislative rule, and they are an interpretation that is completely permissible because it is consistent with the language and the policy of the Investment Company Act, and it's completely rational because it's based on consideration of the relevant factors and based on consideration of investor protection. Mutual funds must sell and redeem their shares at prices reflecting their current net asset value, which is next computed after receipt of a sale or redemption order. The Act defines value for purposes of pricing shares as market value when market quotations are readily available, and when they are not, as fair value as determined in good faith by the Board of Directors. If fund shares are mispriced, that is, if they are sold at a price that does, sold or redeemed rather, at a price that does not reflect the current net asset value of the portfolio, shareholder interests are diluted. If shares are underpriced, if fund shares are underpriced relative to the current market value of the fund's assets, purchasing shareholders receive a windfall at the benefit of other shareholders in the fund. Conversely, if shares are overpriced in relation to the current market value of the fund's assets, redeeming shareholders receive a windfall at the expense of other shareholders in the fund. This type of mispricing can occur when a fund calculates its net asset value based on a market quotation for a fund's portfolio security that no longer reflects the current market value of that security as of the time the fund calculates its NAV. The most common example for this sort of situation is if there is a portfolio security that is traded on a foreign exchange that closes many hours before the United States funds price their NAVs, which is typically at 4 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. There is an event that has occurred after the closing of that foreign exchange that's going to affect the value of that portfolio security. The closing quotation, which was established 10, 12, however many hours earlier, will no longer reflect the value of that portfolio security at 4 p.m. Eastern Time when the fund is calculating its net asset value. Consequently, the Commission has interpreted the Act's valuation requirements to require funds, when they're calculating their NAV, to use the current market value of their portfolio securities to calculate that NAV and determine what that current market value is as of 4 p.m. If there's an exchange-traded security in the U.S., that's not difficult because we're in the same time zones. Securities that trade on exchanges that close hours before the United States exchange funds calculate their net asset value, there may be, if an event has occurred subsequent to the close, that won't necessarily be a current net asset value.
But you're treating readily available market quotations as unreliable. How do you get that from the statute?
Your Honor, we believe that reliability must be a component of determining whether a market quotation is readily available, because the premise of the Investment Company Act is accurate pricing so that when shareholders sell or redeem their fund shares, they are receiving their appropriate pro rata value of the fund's assets. If a fund uses a quotation that is no longer accurate for a portfolio security when it calculates its NAV by definition is going to be inaccurate.
But that's where it gets the difference between interpretation and statute making. I mean, you're completely in a different, aren't you completely in a different area where you talk about reliability or unreliability?
We don't believe so, Your Honor, because the statute specifically requires that fund pricing be conducted in a manner to reduce or eliminate dilution to the interests of shareholders, which would occur if a market quotation does not reliably reflect the current value of that portfolio security, and also to eliminate unfairness to shareholders from the sale or redemption of shares at prices that do not reflect their current net asset value.
On balance, this, would you say this benefits the mutual funds as opposed to operations such as the plaintiffs in this case?
Your Honor, we believe that this benefits investors. It's not something designed to
benefit. You've got investors on both sides, I guess, in mutual funds and here.
That's true, Your Honor, but the investor whose interest is in an inaccurate price, essentially, a price that no longer reflects the current net asset value, their interest is going to dilute the interests of other shareholders. And the Act specifically, it's really, I think, unique among securities acts in terms of specifying the policies that it was intended to combat and that it is to be interpreted.
What they're doing is not illegal.
No, it's not, Your Honor. It's not, but that doesn't mean that the Commission can't take steps to combat it. And it's quite clear that market timing is a problem for funds, and it's completely legitimate to take various steps to combat it, trading restrictions on the number of trades an investor can make, redemption fees, things of that nature. Everyone recognizes that a rapid in-and-out trading to exploit a price that no longer reflects the current market value of the fund's assets is damaging to other shareholders in the fund. And it isn't DH2 has indicated that somehow it's improper to look out for the interests of long-term shareholders versus the interests of those who would want to actively reallocate their assets or actively trade, however it's described. We basically have two responses to that. First is all investors benefit from accurate pricing of shares. Secondly, it's quite clear just from the nature of mutual funds that people investing in them, it's a longer-term investment. They're not designed for this type of in-and-out trading because one of the great advantages of mutual funds is diversification of assets. That only works over the long term. It doesn't work within a day or so. Another advantage of the mutual funds is people who are not professional investors or professional managers are relying on the expertise of another of the fund share, of the fund management to do their investing. If those sorts of characteristics really are designed for longer-term investors, not investors who come in, only hold shares for a few days, even up to a couple of weeks, that's not what mutual fund trading is designed for. And I should address just a couple of points that were raised in DH2's argument. I think for the first time we've heard today that DH2 is now asserting that these statements, the statements that they're challenging, interfere with private contractual rights. They haven't raised that argument before, and there's certainly nothing in the record that would support that claim. Additionally, it seems like DH2 has conceded that market timing is a problem, and they don't really have a problem with the other steps the Commission has taken to address this. They just have a particular problem with these statements. One thing that DH2 does do is completely mischaracterize the challenge statements. They try to portray them as a wholesale abandonment of market quotations in favor of fair valuation, which they are not. The challenge statements themselves make it very clear that there's very narrow circumstances under which, you know, a fund should use fair valuation instead of an existing market quotation. Additionally, they don't give fund managers untrammeled discretion to abandon fair value pricing because fund managers have a good faith duty to their shareholders. The SEC enforces the securities laws and the investment company laws and polices them. Additionally, fund management is subject to shareholder actions if they act in violation of the Investment Company Act. So it's not a situation where the SEC has given fund management carte blanche to abandon market quotations whenever they see fit. What the SEC has stated in the challenge statements is when a market quotation does not reflect the current value of the fund's portfolio securities at the time NAV is calculated, that's when they must use the alternative method of valuation in the statute, which is fair valuation.
But that's, of course, a totally subjective.
Fair valuation is certainly involves a degree of subjectivity, but Congress, in putting the ICA together, used that as one of the two valuation options, market value when market quotations are readily available, or fair value.
But that's, of course, when thin markets and or privately traded. Isn't that really where the breakdown is?
Your Honor, the Commission believes that all of the prior statements that the Commission has made regarding when market quotations are readily available and portfolio valuation have the common theme that they exclude market quotations that do not reliably reflect the current value of the portfolio security as of the time the fund calculates its NAV. So a thin quotation does not reliably reflect current value because there simply aren't enough trades. An event that occurs after a market closes that affects the value of the security, by definition, that closing quotation will no longer be accurate as of the time the fund calculates its trades. So that's what's common to all of these statements, and the Commission's position on that has been consistent. The Commission has used unreliable as a way of summarizing the prior guidance, but it's clear that when it says unreliable, what it means is a market quotation that no longer reflects the current value of that portfolio security as of the time NAV is calculated. And that's such a mouthful that it makes sense to have a shorthand way to describe it. DH2 can't establish standing because they have no injury. These statements do not impose any obligations on them. They haven't alleged that they've lost money, that they've lost investment opportunities, that their interests have been diluted. There is no actual injury. Any injury that they would claim is speculative, absent coming in and saying that they have actually lost money based on this. There is no way of telling. There is no way to know based on the challenge statements. Let me go back. Any claim of injury that they have is entirely speculative, because since the challenge statements direct funds to fair value when market quotations do not reflect the current market value of a security, fair valuing, which is, albeit involving some subjectivity, an effort to determine what price that security would command in a current arm's-length transaction, should result in more accurate pricing. Any argument that it does not, without the context of an actual application, is completely speculative.
It's clear, though, that the SEC's action is going to make it harder for arbitragers to make money off of mispricing. That was the whole purpose behind it, wasn't it?
Certainly, Your Honor, it would make it harder for arbitragers to make a profit off exploiting stale market quotations, yes. But there is no legally protected right to trade at a price that does not reflect the current net asset value. So that can't be a cognizable harm. And they don't even really claim that. Their claim of harm is very vague and completely speculative. They say they're going to suffer an economic injury and that shares will be mispriced. But there's absolutely no evidence of that, because fair valuation should only be used under the challenge statements when relying on the market quotation would cause the shares to be mispriced, because the quotation no longer accurately reflects share value.
Is it fair to say that this action by the SEC achieves greater protection for long-term shareholders at the expense of the short-termers?
I don't know that I would agree, Your Honor, that it